Welcome everyone to a surprise episode of the Beyond MD podcast. I wasn't planning on doing an episode this week, but as you all know, the federal budget was unveiled on Tuesday, and there were some surprising changes. I think one that everyone is talking about is the change to the capital gains inclusion rate. So that's what we're going to be talking about today, and especially how is that going to impact Canadians as individuals and also corporations and trusts. And to help me out with that today, I'm so happy to have Ali Spinner back on the show. So this is Ali's third time on the podcast. So I think most of you will know her, but in case you don't, Ali is a partner in tax at Crowe Soberman. And in my mind, she has too many accolades to summarize on this pod, but in my mind, she's one of the most sought after and trusted voices in tax in the country. That's why I'm so excited to have Ali back. So Ali, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. You're too kind. So it's my hat trick episode. I like that. I'm excited to be here. Let's do it.
Yes, that's right. I'm so excited. So Ali, the capital gains inclusion rate changed, but just sum that up for us. Like, what exactly happened? And talk to us what happened in absolute terms, in relative terms, and how this is going to affect individuals, corporations, and trusts.
Perfect. So I'm going to give everyone a little bit of a tax 101 lesson, which I do love to do, and I'll catch everybody up. There are a couple things, though, that I want to caveat with and say. Number one, we've not seen any draft legislation. And that's really important to highlight, because until the legislation comes out, we're using our best guess. We're probably pretty darn close as to what we think is going to happen, but we actually haven't seen the legislation. So if there's very specific questions, it's a bit of a who knows. We'll see what happens when we get there. That's number one. Number two, I want to remind everybody that we are now in 2024 in the world of alternative minimum tax. This is a discussion for another podcast, another episode. That's fine. But I don't want to pretend that alternative minimum tax doesn't exist when considering what the change in the capital gains rate is, because it does, which really goes to say that for some individuals who are listening, your tax rate on a capital gain might already be higher depending on how large your gain is in any given year. And we'll talk about that when we get into specifics. The third thing that I wanted to mention is that I have no idea if the provinces are going to follow suit or not. I'm assuming that they are. When you see the numbers in the paper about what the capital gains tax rate is, everyone's assuming that the provinces are going to follow suit. If they don't, oh my goodness, it's going to make it a mathematical nightmare for people like me. Not like you, but
yeah. I didn't even think about that.
We're going to have to figure out. And also, there'll be more, provincial arbitrage about, well, if some provinces do and some provinces don't. But let's not worry about that. I just wanted to say that I'm assuming that the provinces are all going to follow suit. Okay, so let's talk about capital gains. What are they? What does it mean? What are the rates? So big picture, in Canada, we're allowed to own assets that appreciate in value, and we don't pay tax on the appreciation until the earlier of three times. Those three times are that we either sell the asset, we leave the country and we depart Canada, or we pass away and we leave the asset to somebody other than our spouse. So at one of those three times, what happens is that currently, for the last about 24 years, since about the year 2000, only half of the capital gain or the appreciation is taxable. That's called the inclusion rate. So only 50% of the gain would come into taxable income. And then your marginal rate of tax, whether you're a corporation, which was a flat tax per se, or an individual with a marginal rate, or a trust with a marginal rate or flat tax, your highest tax rate would then be applied. So let's consider an individual for a second. In Ontario, our highest marginal tax rate is 53.5%. So if we pay only half tax on capital gains, that means that our highest marginal rate on capital gains for individuals, ignoring AMT, is 26.7%. If you do the math for a corporation, if you realize a capital gain up until now through a corporation, the current immediate tax was 25%. What's happening is that the budget is proposing to increase the inclusion rate. So whereas I keep saying that the gain is only half taxable, the gain will now become two-thirds taxable. So instead of including half of the gain into income, we'll now have to include two-thirds of the gain into income. The result is that the personal capital gain tax rate will rise in Ontario from 26.7% by about 9 absolute points to 35.7%, and which represents a 33% overall increase in the rate of tax. And for a corporation, it's a little bit different in a corporation, but for a corporation, the immediate capital gain tax rate will rise from about 25 points to 33 and a half points. Something else that I wanted to say, though, that's important to individuals is that individuals have been afforded in this budget change a proposal where each year, every individual would be able to benefit on the first $250,000 of gross capital gains from the existing 26.7% tax rate. So that is something that's afforded to individuals. It's not afforded to trusts. It's not afforded to corporations. Corporations and trusts will pay this new tax rate on dollar one, but individuals will have this, call it marginal rate on capital gains for $250,000. And then all capital gains above the $250,000 annual limit would be taxed individually at 35.7%.
Okay, super helpful. So with a quick numerical example, yep. Let's say an investor has a capital gain of $100,000 that they are realizing. Mm-hmm. So now what we have to understand is instead of half of that gain being included, it's going to be two thirds. So back in the day, well, before June 25th, it would be 50,000 of that capital gain would be included in taxable income. But now that's rising to $67,000 included, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So you outline the difference between individuals and corporations. So my question right off the bat is, doesn't this proposed change somewhat violate the principle of tax integration? I'm curious on your thoughts there. And then I have a follow-up question because I didn't even think about this, but if all capital gains are going to be taxed at inclusion rate of two-thirds for corporations, then that makes me wonder, for things like rental property, we were typically told that it may be a good idea to hold it through a corporation like a holding company. But now people are asking, well, things like rental property, where should that be held? Should it be held personally? Should it be held through a holdco? I'm curious on your take on all these things.
Okay, so there's two very key questions that you've asked there. I'm gonna answer the second one first. The question of where you should own the asset. So the bottom line is this. If you're a medical professional or any professional who is able to incorporate or somebody who owns an active operating business and you were able to benefit from deferral, meaning that the profit that you don't need to fund your personal living expenses from your annual results of your operating business, if you are able to benefit from deferral and tax that money only at the corporate level, be it at 12% at the small business deduction rate or let's say 26.5% at the general rate, for sure you still very likely want to invest that money through the corporation. Because so I'm looking at it from the perspective of where does the first dollar come from? If the first dollar is coming from an active operating business, you can pay corporate active tax rates and make the investment. You are still likely to be better off to fund that investment with dollars that have only been subject to tax at 12.2 or 26.5% tax versus pulling that money out all the way, paying 53% tax and then making the investment. You do raise an interesting point in that an individual is afforded that $250,000 annual capital gain threshold, I would say, to pay tax at the old rate. I don't know, certainly from the perspective of, I wouldn't run to take money out of a corporation to make an investment personally, but if you are lucky enough to have personal cash, whether because from money that you made from before you incorporated, or perhaps you inherited money, you won the lottery. I actually have a bunch of lottery winners in my practice too. If you happen to have personal cash, I absolutely think there's a question of, well, should you make that investment personally or should you make it through a corporation? It really depends. I would say the key would be is that you're very likely want to have some amount of capital appreciating assets in your hand so that each year you could use up that $250,000 exemption if you're able to do so to average down your overall capital gains tax rate. There are many, many, many levers though that go into this discussion. I know right now we're only looking through this with a tax lens. Even though I'm a tax planner, a tax accountant, I don't love looking only with a tax lens. You also have to consider estate taxes, U.S. estate taxes, probate fees, litigation, family law, liability, a whole host of issues. On a purely tax basis, I buy it. I'd want to be able to have the ability to trigger some gains personally each year in my own personal hands, but that's one of many factors. So that answers your second question. I'm going to go back and see if I can remember the first question now. Do you remember the first question?
Sorry, I need to do a better job of maybe asking questions one at a time. But it seems like to me, the difference that has been put in place for corporations versus individuals, the latter having that $250,000 threshold, it just seems like, isn't that violating the principles of tax integration?
It's not. I mean, it is and it's not. And, you know, I have mixed feelings on this. So let's just, what is tax integration? What does that mean? And I'll explain to you why it's kind of not in a second. Well, or maybe it kind of is. I don't know. Maybe you'll change my mind. But the theory of tax integration is that you are generally indifferent as to whether you earn a dollar of revenue, be it from your active operating business, medical practice, professional corporation, or even investment income. You are generally indifferent as to whether you earn that dollar personally or you earn that dollar through a corporation. The reason we love corporations is because if we can get tax deferral on active operating business, we might as well invest. You know, the government is effectively giving us a loan of that future tax and we can earn a return of investment on it. So back to your point. How about this? The current tax rate in a corporation on a capital gain in the future, let's talk about in the future rate. The current tax rate in a corporation on a capital gain will now be 33.5 percentage points. And you're right. On the first $250,000 of capital gains on an individual, it'll be 26.77%. Now, if you want to talk real integration, we actually have to look at the corporate tax rate on a fully flowed through basis. The tax rate, so if you earn that money in the corporation and then you pull it out, you pull out the capital dividend account, you pull out the taxable dividend, what are you left with? That capital gain tax rate in the corp that started at 33.5% actually rises to almost 39%, because there is a little bit of future tax when you pull money out of a corporation for investment income. So let's say we're looking at 39%. So you are 100% right. We are comparing the ability to earn capital gain or pay capital gain taxation at 26.7% personally on $200,000 each year with an integrated tax rate of almost 39% through a corporation. Now, the one thing I would say though is that, and this is where it's definitely true, it's definitely an argument. However, the only reason we're stuck with this under integration or over integration, whatever you want to call it, is because we were given the ability to benefit from deferral in the first place. If we didn't have the ability to benefit from deferral and only pay 12 or 26% on the profit from our services businesses in the first place, we wouldn't even have this challenge to begin with. So that's where yes, you're 100% right. It is a change in integration. I'm not sure how we got the benefit of deferral. There's still a mathematical answer to it, how many years you use that benefit of the deferral, course, but it is what it is. You didn't have to use the deferral.
So I thought that's what you were going to say, that a corporation can still be a really powerful vehicle because you have tax deferral. So you're kind of paying that low rate, 88 cents on the dollar. But I will say, Ali, like in our forums and in our groups, physicians, dentists, like people are asking, with these new changes, is it still worthwhile? You know, if you can check off those boxes, is it still worthwhile to incorporate?
Absolutely.
Maybe that's, absolutely. Yeah, I would think yes as well. But you mentioned a very important point right at the start, that this has not been drafted in legislation. So what I want to ask is, let's just say from now until June 25th of this year, that the government does not see people selling left, right, and center, and they don't get a big inflow of tax revenue. Then if this isn't drafted in legislation, I guess what other changes could happen? Like, could there be another shoe that falls?
There could always be another shoe that falls. I don't expect to. So let me just explain that. I do expect that the legislation will be drafted imminently. I've already been emailing the Department of Finance all my thoughts on, make sure you think about this, make sure you think about this, because there's all these little loopholes and questions. I have many clients who've actually already entered into, they've entered into deals to sell assets with third parties, but the deals aren't closing until July, and they want to make sure that the deal's set in, you know, that they're going to benefit from the rate because the deal has been entered into. Who knows? We'll see what happens. So there always could be another shoe to drop. To be perfectly honest, I do expect, you know, my practice is really made up of Canada's wealthiest people, whether it's high performance professionals or Canada's wealthiest families. And there are many people who are going to be, if they otherwise would have been triggering gains in the foreseeable future, they are very likely going to be triggering gains in 2024. So I think that they actually are going to see the intended result, which is to A, increase tax, but B, get a lot of tax really quickly into the government's hands.
Ali, I'm so curious, based on all the conversations you're having, what is the most common question that you are being asked this week?
How much departure tax do I have to pay to leave the country? I'm being very serious. It's I can't say that I'm getting those questions from physicians or other incorporated professionals.
Yeah.
But it's actually very concerning. I'm getting that question from high net worth families. I'm getting that question from founders of tech companies. I'm getting that question from I've had the discussion now probably. I've probably spoken to 8 of my clients in the last 2 days to talk about this, with a promise that once I get through tax filing season in April, I will be calling them back in May to discuss it with them again. I've probably had 8 of those conversations over the last 10 years. I've now had 8 in the last 2 days. It makes me nervous because I think the government's going to get a lot of money very quickly from people who leave the country, but then the government is giving up the right to earn future tax revenue from future gains from all these people who are leaving.
Exactly. Ali, maybe you can give us like a brief summary of over time, over history, like how has the capital gains inclusion rate changed? My understanding is that this is not always static, obviously, and at times it's been probably even higher. Because this could change again, right? We could have 100%. New rules coming in that could go down again. Can you give us a quick snippet?
Yeah, sure. So since the year 2000, the capital gain inclusion rate, so capital gains have been 50% taxable. In the year 2000, there was a change. There was actually 2 changes in that year. Let's say from the year, and I'm going by memory, but I think I'm right, from the year 1990 until 1999, capital gains were 3/4 taxable. So the inclusion rate was 75%. And then what happened in the year 2000 is that capital gain, the inclusion rate, first it dropped from 75 to 66 2/3, and then it dropped again a couple months later into 50%. So before, believe it or not, V-Day, a day that's very relevant for many accountants, before 1972, capital gains were not taxed at all. There was no such thing as capital gains tax before 1972. Oh, wow. In 1972, everybody had to value their assets. And you know, as I've been practicing now for over 20 years, but when I started back in around 2000, it was much more common that I had clients who had owned assets since V-Day, because it was only about a 30-year hold back then. And when they were selling them, I'd have to, where's your V-Day report? What was the value in 1972? Because there was no tax. Those days are now about 50 years behind us, so it's less and less relevant. But so the capital gain rate does fluctuate. There's no, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not a political pundit or an economist. I don't know where things are going. Listen, they could tax them as regular income. In the United States, capital gains that are short-term capital gains, meaning that if you buy an asset and you sell it in the same year, it's taxed as regular income. They have a short-term and a long-term hold period. Like, quite frankly, in Canada, if the CRA determines that you're a day trader, your profits tax is regular income also. So anything's on the table. Who knows? I don't expect that we'd get to 100%, but you never know.
Ali, let's move on to what can people do. So let's take the first scenario. One could do absolutely nothing. And this scenario I see as maybe a reasonable one if you're a long-term investor, like you have a long runway ahead of you. Because Ali, I can tell you, I've fallen into this trap many times where I hear a lot of news. I hear, not noise, but in this case, but I don't fully understand something. And then I am like driven by the tax consequences. And then I interrupt that compounding process. Like I have regretted these decisions in the past. So one option is that people could do absolutely nothing. And I see that as a very viable option for somebody with a long-term horizon. What do you think though?
So 100%. It's just, I say this all the time. It's just math, right? I built out a model effectively. Number one, if you're a long-term holder, you're still a long-term holder. You're not going to do anything, right? And by the way, I would encourage all of your listeners, please don't run out and start selling things immediately today. Like, be rational.
100%.
Don't be emotional. be rational. Don't be emotional and wait for the legislation to come out. But for example, at an 8% rate of return, the decision time is 6 years. If you were planning on holding an asset for longer than 6 years, or 6 years or longer, I should say, at an 8% rate of return, you're better off to do nothing now, hold the asset and sell it in 6 years or longer out. If you were going to otherwise sell it in 2 years, sure, you might be inclined to sell it sooner because you would be better off. If you have an elderly parent, and if you have an elderly parent who's sitting on a bunch of gains, and that elderly parent, if they're otherwise going to pay those gains when they pass away, but you think that time might be, sooner than later, you may want to have your elderly parent liquidate their portfolio in early June to be able to take advantage of the current capital gains tax. Yes, you are prepaying tax. You are absolutely having someone pay tax earlier than they otherwise would have to. But if you can do that and save a whole bunch of tax, because if their time that they would otherwise be paying tax is 2 years out and you're just bringing it forward and you're saving money, it's probably the right decision.
Right. And I think that point is really important. If you were going to be selling things anyways in the near term future, like in the foreseeable future, then this window of time may be a good time to realize some gains. But two kind of follow up questions on this. One, you already mentioned alternative minimum tax. So let's say you have somebody who has sizable capital gains, like several hundreds of thousands. I guess there is an interaction between capital gains and the new AMT rules, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you have a certain threshold, then you may be paying more tax anyways, even though you are selling before June 25th. Can you just give 100%. Us a big picture overview of the interaction between AMT and the new capital gains inclusion?
Sure. That's unfortunately the most loaded of loaded questions. Not your fault. It's just that alternative minimum tax is one of the most convoluted, complex ways of thinking about taxation. But effectively, what alternative minimum tax is the government wants to make sure that Canadians are paying a floor of, it used to be 15, now it's 20.5%. So what happens is that they look at your various income sources, and the more efficient your income is, the more alternative minimum tax, or the chances of you paying alternative minimum tax, the likelihood rises. And when I say the more efficient your income is, well, capital gains are efficient because they're only half taxable up until June 25th. Dividends are efficient because the rate on a dividend is less. Income, bonuses, interest, straight income, least efficient. You pay full tax. There's no efficiency there whatsoever. So what happens in alternative minimum tax is the government has changed the rules. They've changed the way that the tax base is computed. And what it's resulting in is that where something might be included one way for regular income tax purposes, it's included differently for alternative minimum tax purposes. The bottom line is this. The bottom line is that, and I should also mention that alternative minimum tax only kicks in if your taxable income is above $173,000.
Right.
So one of the key things is that the point I wanted to make is that if you are having a massive sale of an asset right now in 2024, between January 1st and June 24th, it is very possible that you are already in the world of alternative minimum tax. To be quite honest, the planning to be done for AMT was last year. Last year, most of my clients, if they had assets with extremely large gains in them held personally, we rolled those assets into corporations because the AMT doesn't apply to corporations. It applies only to individuals. So those clients win in this sense. Yep. One client called me yesterday and he goes, "Oh my God, Al, you saved me $1.8 million. I want to kiss you." I'm like, "Sure, pay my bills. That'd be great." But in all seriousness, the point is that you have to consider if AMT, that's why I just don't want people running to start selling things really fast and then have this big surprise come April of 2025, where it's like, "Oh my God." Now, the one thing I'll say about AMT is that AMT is not necessarily a permanent tax. So AMT is creditable for up to 7 years, meaning that if you find yourself having to pay AMT in 1 year, in the tax software that you're using to prepare your tax return, a parallel calculation is being undertaken where it compares in any future year the regular income tax that you would pay and the alternative minimum tax otherwise determined. And if the regular income tax in any future year is higher than that alternative base, you can use as a credit any of that alternative minimum tax paid in the past to reduce your income tax down to where your AMT should be for the year. But what I do find is that for some clients, the alternative minimum tax, if you can recover it in the future, I don't want to say who cares. It's a prepayment of tax. I'd rather you not pay tax until you have to. Mm-hmm. But if your gain in 1 year is so large and you can't possibly recover it in the next 7 years, it becomes a permanent tax. That's how I think. Okay.
Next thing I just want to pick away at very briefly, I was listening to a budget update episode by Amanda Doucette. So mm-hmm. on her Tax Trick podcast, yep. I'll just give her a quick shout out.
But she's awesome. Yeah.
She is awesome. And you know what? She was mentioning the GAR rules, like G-A-A-R, so general mm-hmm. anti-avoidance rules. Mm-hmm. And I guess I don't fully understand this, but could we have a scenario where we have an investor who decides, I want to go on an asset selling binge between now and June 25th. Could there be any way that this individual runs into problems with the new GAR rules at all?
So that's a great question. So GAR is a section of the act where, effectively, think of it this way. If you're being too cute and you're trying to take advantage of something and that wasn't what the legislature intended when they created the rule, the government can challenge you on it. And we're in a new world of GAR. GAR has changed in 2024. The bottom line is this. If you go on an asset selling binge, and it's a true asset selling binge, even if you buy the asset back, like if you own an investment portfolio and you sell the assets to take advantage of the immediate reduced rate of capital gains taxation, I don't expect that to be GAR, even if you buy the asset back, if you've actually gone through and had a sale and bought it back. Where I do think you will have an issue is that the reason why I mentioned a few minutes ago that the year for planning around AMT was 2023, I think that you could have an issue. I don't know for sure, but we'll have to wait and see what the courts think about this as court cases move through the system. I think you could have an issue if you try to either restructure your affairs internally, meaning that if you, between now and June 25th, take assets, roll them on a tax-deferred basis to a corp to avoid the AMT personally, and then sell them from the corporation to take advantage of the lower capital gains tax rate before June 25th. Could GAR apply? Maybe. Also, if you have an asset that isn't liquid, right? So it's, if you have a public company portfolio, it's easy to liquidate it and buy it back. It's probably not that difficult. Of course, there's, market fluctuations and things like that you got to be careful of. But if you have a piece of real estate, or if you have an operating business, and you effectively want to manufacture, this is the old capital gains strip that people were probably talking about lots and lots last year. Not that I love them. I'm not really a fan of capital gains strip. And I think they were oversold. And I think people pretended that the benefits were much larger than they are. Doesn't matter. It's in the past. No hard feelings. I'm just teasing. But effectively, what people are going to want to try to do is they're going to want to try to manufacture an internal sale where they don't have to actually dispose of the asset, but they want to be able to pay current tax at current rates on the current gain within the asset, step up the basis in the asset, so that they will only have to pay the higher rate of tax on future growth. And the point that Amanda was likely making, I haven't listened to her podcast yet, the point that she was likely making is that that might have been easier to accomplish with less worry about being caught by GAR in 2023. There's more concern in 2024 and forward that a transaction like that could be challenged easily by the government.
Okay. I think GAR is fascinating. It's something that we don't, at least myself and the people I talk to, we don't know much about it. It's a great podcast episode, I think, down the road. But, okay, so we've talked about do nothing if you have a long-term horizon. We've talked about selling assets. The third thing is just tax planning. So some of the more, I guess, tax planning vehicles that we are used to hearing about are individual pension plans and corporately-based permanent life insurance or corporately-owned permanent life insurance. And typically, these would be done at a certain stage in life when you have paid off your debts. Maybe you're of a certain age. Ali, with these new changes to the capital gains inclusion rate, my question is, Has the definition of kind of who and when would somebody benefit from IPPs and permanent life insurance, has that changed for you at all in light of the new changes?
I don't think it's changed at all in light of the new changes. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think that a lot of people are going to be wanting to up the amount of insurance that they purchase because their eventual capital gains tax on death is going to increase. I'm a big fan of insurance for a purpose. And people ask me about insurance all the time. I'm a big fan of insurance for a purpose. And this is one of those purposes. Tax on death, liquidity on death is a definite purpose and use of life insurance. And I think what you're going to see is people realizing that if they had computed their tax on death to be $5 million, well, now it might be $5.5 million and they don't have enough insurance to cover it. And they're going to want to increase those policies. So nothing of what you're describing, kind of being all the different cornerstones of reasons to incorporate and benefits from being able to incorporate, those are all still there. Those are all absolutely still there.
Okay, so what I'm kind of getting is things like individual pension plans, insurance, you know, these are strategies when used the right way. Just because we had a change in the rules, it does not mean that people should be like jumping all into these things. Because I can tell you, I'm getting emails about this already being like, hey, you should think about corporately owned permanent life insurance. And I'm like, yeah, well, let me digest this and then let me figure out where I am, what my needs are. I think it serves a purpose, but there's a lot of conversation happening about this stuff.
So there's going to be a lot of conversations about it. The insurance community knows full well my take on insurance. And I absolutely think that insurance for a purpose makes a lot of sense. It absolutely makes a lot of sense, and it can be used appropriately. I hope that we don't see the proliferation of insurance used for the nefarious things that it can be done. Like, an insurance in and of itself is a beautiful tool that can provide a very tax efficient result to someone like a physician. There's no question. And in its most basic vanilla use, meaning that, you know, listen, your capital gains on death just went up, or your investments are going to be, it's all true. That's all true. And if you're using it for that very vanilla use, for sure. I do agree.
Okay. So we are getting right to the end of it. I was going to ask you about the impact on kind of, you know, death and estate planning. And I think you've already addressed that there. Now, the fourth thing that people can do is they can leave the country. This is a slightly facetious question, but I know you're getting it a lot. I guess for people who were maybe planning on leaving Canada this year, maybe for some people that plan has accelerated, maybe they want to leave sooner.
Yes.
Because I guess if people are leaving later, they could be caught with a higher departure tax bill in light of these new changes, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as I mentioned before, when we leave Canada, we're subject to tax on the growth of our assets, with the exception of things like Canadian real estate or Canadian registered plans, pension plans. We're subject to tax on anything that the government can't get their claws into when you're gone, right? So they can get their claws into Canadian real estate and pension plans and things like that. So for sure, anybody who was thinking of leaving or toying with the idea is now the time to do it. Is now the time to do it. Is now the time to sell my assets and buy them back so that when I leave the country, I don't have departure tax, right? You can achieve the same goal by just liquidating and buying back your assets so that you've stepped up the basis in your cost basis. So that achieves the same thing. So that's definitely happening. I always joke, people always ask, and by the way, there will still be, with departure planning, it's still a lot of talk and not a lot of action. And I've already seen a message that, you know, Pierre Polyev has said, don't leave, we're going to fix it all. Who knows? And number one, they got to get elected. Number two, they got to keep their election promises. Number three, they got to realize that the government isn't broken, that they can find money from other ways, because they still have to spend something, even if they want to have lower tax. So who knows? But it can be a lot of talk and not a lot of action, but I think we'll see some action now.
And my very last question, Ali, is I understand the lifetime capital gains exemption went up. This is relevant for people who maybe have a sellable business, let's say a dentist. But was this a meaningful change, or was this like a compensatory change because we also had a rise in the capital gains inclusion rate? I'm wondering what your take is on this.
I think it's a great question. You're right. The capital gains inclusion rate rose. So it was indexed before and it was already around, it was already over $1 million. They've now increased it. They increased the floor or the threshold to $1.25 million. So they, you know, they're kind of giving you an instant. And I actually think, I can't remember if it's after June or if it's actually for 2025, but they're kind of giving you an instant. If you sell your business, if you really sell your own business, let's say a $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 tax rebate, it's a nice to have. It's not, I don't think it's going to make a meaningful, you know, it's not enough to move behavior, but it's a nice to have. The one thing I'll say too is there was a new capital gains exemption for entrepreneurs. Professional corporations are not included in that. So don't get excited.
Not,
No, they're not.
I just came across that yesterday and that exemption level, I don't know even know what the exemption is. It seems pretty high.
There's two more. That one is an up to $2 million additional exemption. It's being phased in over 10 years, but it is definitely not for professional corporations. So that's that one. And then the other one you might have seen is there's a third one where if you have an active operating business and you choose to sell it to an employee ownership trust, you can benefit from a $10 million capital gains exemption.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that one's not cheap, for sure.
Ali, I love your energy and your passion when it comes to tax. I love learning from you. Like, it's been so great to follow you on LinkedIn, and I've seen your name everywhere this week. So on a week like this, the fact that you took time to sit down with me just means the world for me. Thanks for educating me and my listeners.
No problem. My pleasure. And if any of my clients are listening and they're waiting for their personal tax returns, they're coming, I promise.
They're coming. Okay, Ali, lovely to reconnect, okay? And we will chat soon.
Talk to you soon, Yen. Have a great day.
Bye. You too. Bye. Going forward, the final segment of my podcast is going to be called Perspectives. And this is where I offer my perspective on a topic that's related to the interview that you just heard. And we're going to start this now. So I was talking to my dad earlier this week, soon after the federal budget came out, and he told me that he said, Yatin, you have a long runway ahead of you. I really don't think you need to do a thing here. And you know what? The more I reflect on what he said, and I think about the runway ahead, and I think about the rule changes, I really do think he's right. We have a long runway ahead of us, especially if we are early to mid-career. Take a look at your portfolio if you've been investing for at least 5 to 10 years, and take a look at the holdings that have performed the best over time. Most likely, they're going to be the holdings that you have held on to for the longest period of time. It takes time for compounding to work its magic. And I've also learned from experience, when I act on noise and when I act on a tax incentive, I unnecessarily interrupt the compounding process. I've done this before and I've come to regret it. Also take a look at one of the best investors of all time. I'd say the best investor of all time, Warren Buffett. Look at one of his earliest purchases, which was American Express, which he started in the early to mid 90s, just before 1995 or so. When he was buying that stock, it was around $10 a share. What is American Express's share price now? It's $230. It takes time for compounding to work. It's magic. So if you're early to mid-career and you don't need the money in the foreseeable future, then there's a very good chance that you may not need to take any drastic action. On the other hand, if you are later in your career and you expect to need the money in the next several years, or if you were planning on selling these assets anyways in the next several years, then that may make for a much more compelling argument to realize capital gains today, because you will be doing so at a lower tax rate before June 25th. Now, please note, I am not telling anybody to hang on to their assets or to sell their assets. Never any advice on this show, only education, only perspectives. Any decisions to sell or to hang on to assets, this should be run by your accountant. This should be run by your tax professionals. As always, guys, thank you so much for supporting the show. I hope that it was useful. And until next time, stay well, stay savvy.